Our next story is a documentary about one scientist's plan to restore the ecosystem in the American Great Plains. Kate Youngman and Tom James tell us about how importing wild animals from the African savanna could benefit the Midwestern economy and maybe the environment.
For a moment. Imagine that you're in a car taking a road trip across the Midwestern United States. You glance out your window in boredom across the plains. Suddenly, movement catches your attention. You spot an antelope bounding across the dry landscape. It's being pursued by something with amazing speed, a black spotted yellow hide, a cheetah in Kansas. Does this sound crazy? Today, maybe, but if the authors of a recent scientific proposal called Pleistocene Rewilding have their way, there could be wild African animals in America in just a few years. From Stanford University, I'm Tom James.
And I'm Kate Youngman. Tom and I first heard about rewilding a couple months ago. A friend mentioned it to us offhand. It was one of those classic, did you know, statements. This one was, did you know that they might bring large game animals from Africa and release them in North America? Turns out it's true. We were skeptical, but also curious. If somebody does release wild African animals in North America, I'd like to know about it before they get here. So we did some probing. What we found out made us question not only the route we want to take on our next road trip, but also the direction that man is heading in customizing the world to his every want and desire.
Scientists in support of Pleistocene rewilding, which would mean introducing African species to the Midwest, picture rewilding as a win-win situation. We could save endangered species in Africa and profit from ecotourism in the United States. Save the world and make money? Sounds like the American way. Except for the part about wild cheetahs and elephants roving our neighborhoods.
But maybe that's not so un-American after all. The idea of rewilding is summed up in an article by Josh Donlan that appeared in Nature magazine last August. Donlan is a graduate student at Cornell's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. His article, Rewilding North America, explains that Pleistocene rewilding is a project to recreate the wild habitat of many animals that used to live here, in America, at a time when America had even more big predators than Africa.
Donlan was interviewed on NPR's Science Friday soon after the Nature article came out. He described what our continent used to look like before humans showed up. Here's Josh.
At 13,000 years ago, where North America was a very different place, we had our very own lions, cheetah, camels, and lots of large mammals, not unlike Africa. In fact, it was more diverse in Africa 13,000 years ago.
13,000 years ago, our last ice age was ending, and so was the geological epoch called the Pleistocene Era. The animals that became extinct at this time are the ones that Pleistocene rewilding intends to re-establish. But as Donlan knows, even the most dedicated biologist can't just snap his fingers and make extinct animals reappear. So the idea of Pleistocene rewilding is for African animals to fill the niches left by the extinct North American animal. For example, our pronghorn antelope got its speed from years of predation by the American cheetah, which has gone extinct. Bringing the African cheetah into North America would restore this age-old game of cat and mouse.
The introduction of the animals would be a gradual, step-by-step process. Here's Josh.
By no means are we advocating backing up a van and kicking out a van full of cheetah back onto the landscape.
The first step, which is already underway on a few Texas ranches, is to restore the critically endangered Bolson tortoise. Next, they would try introducing some bigger animals to the United States, African herbivores such as camels, asses, and feral horses. The biggest step comes last, bringing in controlled numbers of cheetah, lions, and elephants. They would have to start slow, testing the process on private land. But eventually, Donlan hopes these animals would have a real niche in our landscape. For example, an elephant's trampling on the land helps control local populations of weeds and rodents. Without large animals, these populations get out of control faster than you can say rats and dandelions.
Thank you.
Besides really good road trip stories and first-hand did-you-know tales, restoring the cat-and-mouse game and the biological diversity that goes with it has the potential to enrich life on a global and species-wide scale. To give a mechanical answer to the question of the meaning of life, each species that exists on Earth has some function, whether it's an animal that grazes to prevent the overgrowth of plants, or plants that absorb greenhouse gases and slow global warming. As for the function of humans, well, that question is central to this whole idea of rewilding. Whether we have the right to interfere or the responsibility to protect our planet, human impact is ever on the rise. But interfering with nature certainly isn't the only big question mark in this rewilding scheme. Large carnivores are dangerous and don't always get along with people. Donlin proposes the American Midwest for an experiment in rewilding because Pleistocene animals lived in that region, but also because the human population there is actually declining, along with the farming economy. Donlin and his colleagues hope that struggling farmers might benefit from the ecotourism interest that rewilding could create. He also admits that they would need some really tough fences.
For some expert opinions on human-animal interaction, Kate and I headed to the San Francisco Zoo. But before we even got to meet the keepers who work with the animals all day long, we ran into some visitors who had a few stories of their own.
It was a rainy day, really blustery, with stray branches flying everywhere. We thought the place was going to be deserted until we ran into a young couple admiring a hefty rhinoceros. It was sort of a shock that any visitors would be at the zoo on a day like that. But I suppose that tells you something about our cultural value of wild animals. But not content just to suppose, we went over to talk to the couple. Our venture was outstandingly rewarding. Brian and Jennifer were on a vacation from Indiana, just the place where ranchers and farmers might soon be neighbors with cheetahs and elephants. They were impressed by how close you could get to the animals at this zoo.
The other ones, there's lions, tigers, and bears in all the other zoos, but this is as close as most of the other ones. You'll see a foot hanging out of a cave or something. This is as close as they ever have been to them, really.
We asked them if the average Midwesterner would be receptive to an idea like rewilding.
Probably not. I'm different than most of them. They probably all...
Yeah, they think like I do.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up with, like, a lot of my family is farmers, and, I mean, their livelihood is from raising cattle and, you know, using horses to... Because we live out in Amish country.
It's mostly crops now. It's all in corn and beans. Lions don't want anything to do with corn and beans.
I don't know. I just don't see that it would work very well.
But the husband, Brian, seemed to be a fan of the idea.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. I like them. I'd like to see them around. They don't cause that big of trouble in Africa. They get along.
And he seemed to think that some places in the Midwest would be ideal for an experiment in rewilding.
Really, even like South Dakota. I went on a hunt in South Dakota last year.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to South Dakota?
I have not, actually.
There is nothing in South Dakota. You could turn anything loose in that state and nobody would care. It is.
After visiting the rhinoceros exhibit, we headed up to the lion cages. We were impressed by the sheer size of the creatures, and the fact that they were sleeping soundly. Inside the tiger building, we met a caretaker named Lori, who had worked with carnivores for years, including as a wildlife biologist in Alaska. We asked her about human-animal interactions at the zoo. Even the smallest things, like cell phone pictures, were a problem there.
But with the cell phones, everybody's reaching forward as far as they can to get the picture, and they're not really even thinking about what they're doing, but by them doing that, they're you know, just making it more uncomfortable for the cats that are in here, so we kind of have to constantly remind people.
Lori was interested by the idea of rewilding, but based on her years of experience with big cats, saw the enormous scope of the project a bit daunting. She had spent the last few years of her life fully occupied by taking care of these animals when they had less than 100 square feet of space to run around in. She had trouble imagining a situation in which the caretakers would have significantly less control over the animals and their effect on the environment.
They're not going to manage the breeding population the way it needs to be managed. And, you know, why would you introduce an animal here that, quite frankly, doesn't belong here? I mean, even the wolves have a difficult time surviving here. And when they do start taking over the populations, then the coyotes are pushed out. you know? So I just honestly don't know how that could ever work.
She was also concerned that the local people, such as farmers and ranchers, would never accept a plan like this.
But at the same time, it's like, we can't even restore a wolf, you know? We can't even restore a grizzly bear in California, you know? It's like, how on earth would we ever convince, you know, ranchers and you know, that we're going to restore another carnivore? I mean, they, you know, they don't even want to coexist with what does exist out there.
Almost everyone we talked with at the zoo cited some disaster involved with bringing a non-native species into an ecosystem. Here's Dave, a caretaker at the zoo's African exhibit.
Like in Australia, they had like that severe rabbit problem, and those were all rabbits brought over to Australia, and you know, so you don't want to have another problem like that.
Rabbits are not native to Australia. They were introduced in the mid-1800s partly for sport hunting, and proved themselves worthy of the expression, multiply like rabbits. A rabbit plague of almost biblical proportions ensued. The Australians tried fencing, hunting, and more than one contrived virus, which the rabbits developed an immunity to. The rabbits are still there, in much smaller numbers, but still wreaking havoc with the nation's agriculture and wildlife.
From pigs to dandelions, America has seen its own share of introduced species. They've carried with them a mix of pros and cons, medicinal value along with disease, variety for your dinner plate, as well as competition for native species. Donlin admits,
and there's definitely potential for unexpected ecological consequences from an invasive species context.
But he responds to critiques of rewilding based on these issues in his Nature article. He writes, "Existing lions and cheetahs are somewhat smaller than their extinct counterparts. For example, Camelus is different from Camelops. Same is relative, however, as illustrated by the highly successful reintroduction of peregrine falcons in North America. Captive bred birds from 7 subspecies on 4 continents were used, yet there were no differences among the birds in subsequent breeding success. And subspecies now serve as a collective proxy for the extinct Midwestern peregrine falcon." Rewilding has gotten pretty controversial reports from the press so far. One newspaper that has responded to the gravity of rewilding's ambition is the Christian Science Monitor. We spoke with chief editorial writer Clayton Jones, who's had some experience with large wild beasts himself.
Well, speaking of real wild, I almost got killed by an elephant in Sri Lanka one time, so there you have it.
Seriously?
Yeah, this bull elephant picked up a big branch and threw it at me.
Clayton and the Christian Science Monitor see rewilding as a jumping-off point to talk about how humans handle nature.
Well, rewilding is a great way to talk about what we mean by wilderness, so that when we vote for and act on things like the Endangered Species Act, we know exactly what we're talking about.
Rewilding could help save Africa's endangered species, which might otherwise disappear in the next century. As we consider what to do in this situation, Clayton urges us to think forward instead of backwards.
To think about it in terms of what kind of nature do we want to create, rather than what kind of nature there was in the past.
The real issue gets back to defining what humans' role in nature should be. We found an American definition of wilderness from the Wilderness Act of 1964. Wilderness is defined as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man is a visitor and does not remain. Well, the second part of that is easy enough to understand. If somebody lives there, it's not wilderness. The first part, untrammeled by man, is a little trickier. The author of the Wilderness Act defined untrammeled as not being subject to human controls and manipulations that hamper the free play of natural forces. But humans are a natural force. To take them out of the equation is naive and impractical at best.
Pleistocene rewilding challenges the framework of the existing definition of wilderness. It attempts to move back the conservation benchmark from 1492 all the way back to 13,000 years ago, before man ever began hunting the larger animals to extinction.
And so we're arguing that we need to think farther back than Columbus. Right now, in conservation biology, the de facto benchmark, that is, what we're trying to restore to, is 1492.
But the idea of rewilding is not to define wilderness as late Pleistocene North America. Rather, it shows to what extent the political and cultural concept of wilderness is arbitrary and contrived. There is no longer any true wilderness on Earth, by the Wilderness Act definition. Almost every corner of the Earth has been affected directly by man's presence, if not indirectly by changes in the atmosphere and climate caused by humans. The concept of wilderness is inherently ironic and contradictory.
It is on this ground that the idea of rewilding draws the most logical support. If nature is constantly dynamic and changing, if wilderness is a construct, if nothing is truly wild, then we are left with a choice of either neglecting the diversity of the environment around us or taking an active role in choosing the nature that we want to survive.
Think back to your road trip in Kansas. This time, your grandkids are with you, fighting over a bag of Cheetos in the backseat. Will they recognize a real cheetah if they see it in the plains beside them? Or is a cheetah just a cartoon logo for snack chips?
The Wilderness Act of 1964 is up for renewal. When we redefine our political definition of wilderness, we should accept that preservation is no longer a sensible goal. As Donlan reminds us, a hands-off policy will not prevent extinctions or maintain our current level of biodiversity. In the last 13,000 years, humans have risen to the top of the food chain. Short of climbing back down, we need to acknowledge how much control we actually have over wilderness and use this power to create nature as we see fit. Maybe if we aim to save endangered species, boost the economy, and glorify the wilds of America, we can get a little closer to one of these goals, or all three. Ultimately, it's about survival, ours and the animals. Rewilding could make that survival a little grander for us all. Dave, the caretaker at the zoo, explains why the time and place to do this is ours.
Oh, it'd be a great idea, yeah. I mean, it's hard to do it in Africa because, for, you know, reasons of war and because people need food and, you know, they, you know, that's a lot of food right there. So, you know, you can't really blame people for wanting to survive, you know, even though they're endangered species, you know. So it's going to be harder and harder to keep them in Africa. And it would be a shame to see them go extinct, so I'm all for it.
Dave is right. You can't blame people for wanting to survive. The world is a beautiful place, but it's not perfect. War and famine are pretty hard to get rid of. Natural disasters are even harder. Extinction crises? Well, we're finding out. For every new cure, life brings a new ailment. We know that's part of the game. Life is dynamic and controversial, not static. So better the world for the sake of the world, not for the sake of bettering it.